I want us to engage in some reflection and discussion that I think is appropriate to the bicentennial. My question is, what were they after in 1776, and what are we after today? Let me just ask a whole raft of questions before I begin, and then I'm going to turn to those five things that are written up there on the board. Have you ever thought about it? What exactly is it that we celebrate on Independence Day? I think, truth be, most people celebrate the fact they don't have to work. It's a day off, you know. And I think back, why was I happy on the 4th of July? Well, it's because there was a doubleheader on the radio. We could blow off firecrackers. We usually ate something good instead of roast beef and crap like that. You know, we had something good like hot dog. Little kids don't pay much attention to 4th of July rhetoric. I wonder if adults do. But what exactly is it that we celebrate on Independence Day? As I grew older, I began to reflect on them, and I began thinking, in fact, the very word Independence Day. I mean, independence from what? Yeah, from England? Well, that was obvious, but what value is that? There seemed to be a lot less. I mean, you know, gee whiz, why get so excited about being independent from England, especially when we've been such good friends with England for so many years? You know, England was our ally when I was growing up. But now let me move on. The next question is, forget about just 1776. There's a period of when I refer to the founding, I'm thinking of the period from 1776 to 1789, from the Declaration of Independence to the ratification of the Constitution, the founding, 12, 13 years in there. What was the achievement of the founding? I mean, we've the founding fathers, with capital F, capital F. We're kind of off patriotic celebrations today. You know, we've gotten a little cynical or sophisticated or something. But again, when I was growing up, and when most of you were growing up, I think we felt that stir in our heart, and the framers and all that, and we thought they really achieved something. I knew that when I grew up. I learned it in grade school, and somehow in that period, the founders of the United States had achieved something unique up to that time, and perhaps unique even yet today, a great model. Well, what was it? What was their achievement? Or, I want to raise this possibility because it has been argued and continues to be argued in this century, perhaps there was no single achievement, maybe there were two achievements. There is a school of thought, probably its best known exponent, was the late historian Charles Beard, an argument that says in the Declaration of Independence there was one thrust toward democracy and equality, whereas in the Constitution there was a reaction against this radical belief in democracy and equality in favor of liberty, which means primarily liberty for those who have property. The essence of the Charles Beard argument, his best known book on this subject, was The Economic Interpretation of the Constitution. Beard argued that the people who framed the Constitution really had looked around and said, my gosh, we unleashed a demon. If we don't hedge up these people, the majority is going to deprive us of our property and we're going to have mobocracy. So the Constitution, then, in this view, was a reaction against the flaming sentiments of Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal and are endowed with inalienable rights. Can't have any of that. Well, that's a possibility. But what did the Founding Fathers believe they were doing? And what has their achievement become in our hands? I have now put up here on the board five possibilities of what happened during the period of the founding. And clearly he who asks the questions really sneakily presents the answers. So my way of organizing it begs a lot of questions, I'm sure, but I assure you I do try to consider the possibilities. Let me run through those and comment on each one. In some sense, 1776 was about national self-determination. You know, an independent state clearly was independence from England. And national self-determination is a good thing to be for, I guess. Everybody seems to be for it today. It's one of those phrases, again, which when used in the United Nations, I mean, can you imagine someone standing up in the United Nations and saying, I am opposed to national self-determination. You don't do it. It's a goodie. But what does it mean? You know, the question is, what are the boundaries of the nation? Yeah, I don't think we ask that question often enough. But in our own historical experience, that question came in 1860. National self-determination. All right, if the 13 colonies have the right to govern themselves, determine who shall rule them, why don't the southern colonies have that right? And in the Civil War, we settled that issue by force. There was a right of national self-determination in 1776, but not in 1860. Or that's the way the South decided it. But another way of putting it is that the nation was the United States, and well, but why? If the black people of the United States decided they wanted a separate nation, would they have a right of national self-determination? Why not? What about Puerto Rico? Or take a recent Nigeria was a good example in recent history. Nigeria is composed primarily of three major tribal groupings, which prior to the advent of the European nations had very little to do with each other, and what they did have to do with each other was hostile. But then England comes in, and England and France, you know, they draw the map and they say, this is Nigeria. And they don't bother to consult the natives. And then England leaves and it's left Nigeria. That's the nation, Nigeria. And the Igbo was the tribe that principally revolted. Well, the Igbo had actually been kind of the dominant group for a long time, and they were resented. And then the Igbo were kicked out of their positions of dominance, and as soon as they were, they felt threatened, and they revolted, and they decided they had a right of national self-determination. And they lost the war. And were they suppressed? Where was the spirit of 76? Where should the spirit of 76 have been in that struggle? I don't know. What rights does a nation have anyway? A nation. Or is a nation just one of the most dangerous of abstractions? I use this. I often ask myself, what is a nation? What is the United States? Is it, as Kurt Vonnegut would suggest, a grand falloon? Grand falloon is in Kurt Vonnegut's terminology, is a collection of people who seem to have a lot in common, in fact, have nothing in common. He likes to use the example of the American Legion. or I think being better, Hoosiers. He uses that example too. Hoosiers. Texans. I have this experience, maybe you do too, John. You're traveling somewhere. I was in the Blue Ridge Mountains some years ago, and I stopped to get a hamburger at a joint, and a guy comes driving up. He sees my license plate. He says, hey, you're from Texas, you know. And we were supposed to fall into each other's arms. Is a nation a vicious abstraction or grand falloon? Is it an accident? We just happen to all live within these boundaries. Is a nation geographically defined? Or is it a social contract? That's the way a lot of thoughtful people were going in the 18th century. They were thinking of nations as social contract. Had this notion that they admitted it never happened historically, but our ancestors all got together and said, hey, life is kind of poor, solitary, nasty, mean, brutish, and short, or something like that here for all out, making on our own. So let's get together and form a nation, all righty? It's in everybody's, so we form this social contract and we write the rules of Constitution. Or is it, as Burke said, really a developing organism, something sacred into whose origins you must not even inquire? Well, I'll pass that. Go on. If you think 1776 was about national self-determination and nation founding. What is a nation? And is it worth fighting for? But maybe it was about liberty. The Liberty Bell cracked in 1776, and we think a lot about liberty, talk about liberty, very good word. Liberty from what? From whom? Huh? From England? Now you think about it. We achieved liberty. 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 Who was? That's a great achievement. But who is the enemy to liberty? It isn't England. Not anymore. Is the enemy tyrannical government? Is that what's the threat to liberty? Tyrannical government? Or is it non-representative government? Or are those the same thing? Question, if the government is representative, in other words, if the people who make the laws have been properly elected by the people, can that government be tyrannical? I often ask my students to define liberty. An amazing number of them decide liberty exists when the majority rules. I find that very, very funny. I find that very disturbing. But, is liberty, was the liberty they fought for really liberty from government itself? Oh, you say, but we have to have government. Well, maybe we don't have to have very much. How much government do we have to have? If Thomas Jefferson were resurrected today and looked around at government, the role of government in our lives, representative government, properly elected government, what would he think? What would he say? Would he be horrified? Would he say, my God? Or would he say, complex society requires complex government? Or is it, well, of course, remember, liberty, put it this way. It isn't only government which engages in social coercion. Other people do too. Sometimes, you know, they just, if you were black and some years ago you were traveling through the United States and looking for a decent place to spend the night, you would find yourself not very free. You didn't have many choices. And that wasn't the government doing that. It was simply the prejudices of motel owners, or maybe the fears of motel owners that other patrons had prejudices, and so they didn't want to offend them. Your neighbors can coerce you. In fact, violence is a coercion. Have it ever occurred to you that if you're living in a city where it isn't safe to go out on the streets, you don't have liberty? It's a very important form of you really don't. And there it isn't government that's threatening you. Really, it's the weakness of government that is threatening you. And if the government could enforce the laws, you would be freer. You would have more liberty. But the question is, how much liberty ought we to have? You know, the standard answer is everyone should be free to do whatever he pleases as long as he doesn't interfere with the similar freedom of others. The trouble is that's systematically ambiguous. It really begs the question that we know what legitimate liberty is. May I, for example, take your, I'm hungry. I should be free to eat, so I take your cookie. That's interfering with your right to eat your cookie. All right, but suppose I don't take your cookie directly. You have a gasoline station from which you're earning income, with which you buy cookies, and I set up a gasoline station on the opposite corner, and I'm a better gasoline station operator, and I deprive you of your customers and take your income, and thereby take your cookies. Well, you say, well, that's legit. But why is one legit and not the other? Obviously, we have notions of what is legitimate here. You can't really define freedom, I think, or liberty, without talking about justice. When we say we ought to be free, we're really saying it is just that people be free to do certain things. You know, and if somebody says, suppose somebody's driving down the left-hand side of the highway and a cop stops it. The person says, you're interfering with my liberty. That's absurd. Nobody has the right. You see, you got to get into the right. Nobody has the right to drive down the left. But what rights do we have? I referred to the argument of the populists and progressives know, the tradition coming out of William Jennings Bryan and leading into Theodore Roosevelt, around the turn of the century, there was a widespread feeling in the United States that the great American experiment was being corrupted by the plutocrats, that great wealth and great financial power was coming to control the country, and what was needed was some kind of return to our origins and a purging of the fat cats. That, very oversimplified, is what was running through or what was informing the populist progressive movement. Well, during this period, I said, the view came to be argued that Declaration of Independence had been very much about democracy, the Constitution was very much about liberty for the rich, and that we really had to get back to the principles of 76. Because we had to get back to the principles of 76 in the name of democracy. People rule. That's the important thing, that the people rule. Well, what is democracy? You think about that very often. What constitutes democracy? Again, democracy is one of those words that thou darest not slander in the United Nations. I'm not picking on the United Nations. I'm just saying that I'm assuming that what is acceptable rhetoric in the forum of the United Nations indicates what people consider to be good things and bad things. And everybody's democratic. There's the People's Democratic Republic of Albania. And what nation today would stand up and say, we reject democracy? There are all kinds of forms of government, but they all claim to be democratic. And we say, yeah, but they're cheating. Well, are they really? What's our notion of democracy? Abraham Lincoln talked about government of the people, by the people, for the people. I'm not sure what he meant by those three things, but if you run down through them for a moment, let me give an interpretation of each. Government by the people, well, I take that to mean where one man, one vote. Everybody gets a vote. That's government by the people. Of the people might be town meeting thing, participatory democracy. Now those are very, very, very different, you know. And it's not just, I don't think it's just true that when you get big, then you have to choose representatives, but it's really the same thing. It really isn't the same thing. Because when you are actually participating in the process of government, you're doing something different, you're changing yourself. But of course, I don't want to get any further into that. That's something I very deeply believe, that political life is a process of self-change. But it isn't if you think that we have the essence of democracy and good government, as long as everybody gets a vote, then you're not going to be very impressed by the necessity for participatory democracy, where people are really engaging in dialogue with one another about problems of the political order. Or, you know, the real thing is, the real challenge today between the Marxists and the non-Marxists on whether a government, whether the people, what the people want is what the people ought to have. Is government by the people necessarily government for the people? Suppose that the people have been brainwashed. Suppose that the means of education are entirely in the hands of the capitalists, or that those who teach in the schools, those who write the newspaper editorials or decide what appears in the paper, they have been so steeped in capitalist ideology that they can't even see how absurd this system is. And what is really in the interest of the people is a radically different kind of order that most of the people can't even recognize. Now, it sounds very elitist. Maybe it is. But I would say, in defense of the Marxists who claim that government, the real democracy, is government for the people, even when the people don't know what they are for, the Marxists always claim that after a while, after a period of education, the people will come to say, yes, indeed, that is what we want. But what do you mean by democracy, assuming that you're a proponent? Well, what do you mean? Majority rule? Then how do you distinguish between democracy and tyranny of the majority? Again, that's something that I find my students don't ask. They seem very surprised to hear that there is such a thing as tyranny of the majority. They define it, that's a contradiction in terms. What the majority wants is right. And if you don't like it, what about the rights of the minorities? Does democracy say anything about the rights of minorities? What are the limits on the majority? Or is it possible that democracy is really something quite different from all of this? Bryce, in his very famous book, The American Commonwealth, written in 1887, suggests that democracy is government by discussion. That's an old tradition, too. That's something very different. All right. Or was perhaps America the founding about equality? Well, Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America maintains that the Americans are gung-ho for equality. And again, you go back to the early years and you can find in the period of the founding a lot of talk about equality. There was in 1776 and the years following a very strong hostility toward distinctions of status. You know, the kind of thing that is expressed in the French Revolution in calling everyone citizen, or in the Bolshevik Revolution, everyone's comrade. None of this sir stuff. And the Constitution's hostility toward granting titles. We'll have no titles. We're all common men. In America, we're all proud to be common people. Well, there's the thrust toward equality. Is that really what America was about? That, well, Thomas Jefferson said it. All men are created equal. Now, we've had a lot of fun pointing out that Jefferson was a slaveholder and all of that, but, you know, maybe Jefferson, well, we know Jefferson felt very badly about being a slaveholder. I hope that if you get to Washington and you go to the Jefferson Memorial, that you will read not only the words of the Declaration of Independence, but the, I think, far more moving words written on the other side. I tremble for my nation when I remember that God is just. Commerce between master and slave is despotism. But if America has a strong, and it does, there is in the founding a great deal of interest in equality. Equality with respect to what? Huh? What? What is equal? Then that last one, the good life. You may wonder where that comes in, but there's always been in the American political tradition a sense of we are the chosen people. It perhaps begins with the Puritans who thought that indeed God had sent them out to found the new Jerusalem. But it runs, you know, the idea of manifest destiny was hooked up with it. It's just, we're deeply, that's a rich part of our tradition and a dangerous part of our tradition. It enabled us to get rid of the Indians without a bad conscience because the Indians, you know, weren't part of God's scheme. And God had sent us over here in order to civilize the continent and till it and cultivate it. I don't want to focus on the manifest destiny or the idea that we were a light to lighten the Gentiles so much as that there was, at the time of the founding, the founding fathers and American generation weren't just saying, let's get rid of England, let's have liberty, democracy, equality. They were also saying, let us have the true good life. When they commissioned a statue, they commissioned the same man, what's his name? I can't think of his name. The guy who did the famous statue of Voltaire, Houdon, I think that's right. Help, somebody know? Commissioned him to do a statue of George Washington. He did the statue of Washington in Roman garb with a toga. Well, it was the picture of Cincinnatus. You know, Cincinnatus was this Roman farmer who was called from the plow to lead his nation and fend off the barbarian hordes and then go back to the plow. That was the true good life. Thomas Jefferson, again, has a lot of this running through him. Thomas Jefferson, who you believed in limited government, went out and bought the Louisiana Territory and has often been faulted for that. You know, it's inconsistent with his principles, but Thomas Jefferson had this principle. He believed that we had to be a nation of yeomen, farmers, you know, freeholders, everybody with his own terrain out there, everybody growing his own crops and thereby maintaining a lusty independence and writing his own poetry. And there was a strong conception of what a man, what a human being ought to be, and the belief that the United States of America was going to be a place in which people could become what they really ought to be. That's what I mean by the good life. So that it isn't enough just to have all of these institutions. However, I want to say this about it. There was on the part of the, at least of the adopters of the Constitution, a very conscious decision to soft pedal the Platonic Aristotelian tradition in favor of the tradition of Montesquieu and Locke. You know, if you've read The Republic of Plato, it's dealing with the question of justice. What is justice? And is justice good? And in order to get at that question, Plato, Socrates really have to go back and talk about the nature of being human. And it turns out in The Republic, which is, I think, the product of Plato's most idealistic political thinking. You know, later on he says, it's not attainable, I'll compromise. But what Plato really believed, that the good society and the good life were inseparable. That the good life was only possible in a polis, in a political community, and you had to have the right kind of political community to make the right kind of life possible. So a nation had to be concerned with the character of its citizens. Is that a dangerous notion and contrary to the principles of the Bill of Rights? Well, I will say this, that it was somewhat soft-pedaled, but somewhat soft-pedaled. Madison, for example, who's the big soft-peddler of it, and Hamilton, and Jay, the Federalist Papers here, they're talking about institutions primarily. But there's always in the background that, and sometimes it comes through too, a concern about national character. A guy I admire very much, Irving Kristol, who has said that we've gotten the whole thing turned around. The founding fathers were very concerned about national character, and they were willing to impose some restrictions on people's behavior if it was necessary to improve character. But today, we've decided that there are absolutely no restrictions of any kind to be placed on people, especially when those restrictions might have something to do with moral development. If they merely have to do with, you know, economic transactions, it's all right to restrict them. But if they have to do with moral development, then it is a violation of one's basic freedoms to have the government put down any rules. So he said, thus, if my 18-year-old daughter decides to perform sex on the stage for pay, the state will say that's all right, as long as she's paid the minimum wage. And that's really true. Her employer could be fined for failing to pay her the minimum wage. And we don't see, there's nothing wrong, you know, with the government saying that a woman and a man cannot enter into an arrangement to perform sex. Where did my negatives come? I mean, there can't pass any laws to prohibit arrangements between people to perform sex for pay and for entertainment. But you can prohibit people from entering into free arrangements to, I'll do this for you for $1.90. You know, like wash your dishes. Nope, I can't do that. It's got to be $2.20, even if I decide I won't hire you at $2.20. Well, let's see, that's all I'm going to say. Yeah, I hope I've raised just a whole lot of questions.
One question I have, but I have a history professor.
You're not supposed to have any questions. I ask the questions, you give the answers. Go ahead, I'm kidding. Well, one thing I'm here, I'm just amazed when I go back and read the works of political philosophy written in this period, at the large numbers of men of genius who were, I mean, I think the Federalist Papers ranks with any work of political philosophy. We were indeed most fortunate. They were men of genius. They and one thing I surely agree with, that their conception of democracy was not the conception that most people hold today, and it sounds to me like it's not your history professor's conception of democracy. You know, that's why the Constitution has all of these limitations. They believe that, for example, some of which we've gotten rid of by constitutional amendments, some of which have just evolved into insignificance. The Electoral College was supposed to be a way of keeping the people from getting together and just, you know, electing, you know, some president whom the majority, you know, some guy named Jimmy Carter or something who, you know, has a big smile, or Ronald Reagan who miles, and I, or Well, they were trying to prevent exactly what so easily happens today. Somebody who's got a presence on TV can rile up the majority of the people. Or what they were more afraid of was that somebody would come up with a real popular scheme. For the Electoral College was supposed to be a way of keeping the people from getting together and just, you know, electing some president whom the majority, you know, some guy named Jimmy Carter or something who, you know, has a big smile, or Ronald Reagan who miles and they were trying to prevent exactly what so easily happens today. Somebody who's got a presence on TV can rile up the majority of the people. Or what they were more afraid of was that somebody would come up with a real popular scheme for despoiling the wealthy, for seizing property. They did talk about that a lot, but they thought with Locke that property was essential to liberty. So that they were very concerned to prevent majority rule, which is precisely what many people they mean by democracy. And so senators were not directly elected, but were chosen by the legislatures of the states. Now, was that real democracy? Well, whether they were really Democrats depends, first of all, on what you think real democracy is. And I think that's a toughie.
Yeah, well, I just say, luck is it? What is luck? You know, luck is what we don't yet know how to explain. I think I would rather than say it was luck, I would say I'm extremely grateful. That makes sense. I really do. I really want to celebrate the 4th this year in the bicentennial because I'm extremely grateful for the genius and courage and integrity of those people who founded this country.
Well, you're giving expression, among other things, to a tradition that's very strong in this country among Christians, that there is a kind of correlation between the American political system and Christianity. There was a newspaper I used to get years ago called Christian Economics. I didn't subscribe, it was sent to me. but its masthead said, free enterprise is the system with the least amount of government and the greatest amount of Christianity. And its argument essentially was that anything that increases the power of government decreases the freedom of the individual and hence his capacity to live in a Christian way. That is, I'm not endorsing that tradition, I'm saying, but I think you're expressing that tradition, which is widely held. I don't know, it's Signe or you or name. What's your name?
Earl Peterson. I live in Chicago. Grew up on a farm, love to shoot and ride horseback, things like that. I've been opposed to legislation about guns. About a year ago, last summer, one day I was out in my yard, and I knew I heard someone shooting. It took me 2 or 3 days to find out who it was and where it came from. My neighbor boy, just 1 yard away, was shooting squirrels with a .22. Scared me to death. And I believe in freedom, but not for him. I'm a pastor in a dwindling church in the city. I meet people who are musical, simple church, propagating all kinds of things that are frightening to me as a Christian. And, I'm really struggling with this business of freedom of speech. How free are we to propagate anything that can enter our mind? And, as a Christian person, I find myself very much against my upbringing, beginning to say, no, there have got to be some limitations. And, I find this is a very big struggle that's going on now. See, I know all this stuff about freedom and liberty and a good life, but I see some of this as going past the point of no return or diminishing return, so that there is a destruction that needs to happen because we say, yes, everyone should be able to do what they want to. In our city council, I was thinking this is another another thing, but the majority can become a tyranny. You know, we have our minority aldermen who are always painted as funny little comedians, never winning. And, you know, you begin to say, well, you know, is freedom all that good? Or even more basically, are we as free as we think we are? These are things that are all tied up and going on within me right now, very pertinent to where I am. And you've touched a number of those tender spots this morning. I'm just kind of spewing out a response to you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's the kind of reflection I was hoping for. It gives me an opportunity to point out too that it is very important that we pay attention to what the framing fathers assumed people definitely would not do when they said everyone should be free to do what he wants to do. Edmund Burke said, before I should congratulate a man on his acquiring the freedom to do as he pleases, I would want to know what it is that what it pleases him to do. And we pay attention to that. I mean, it's.
I reckon with this thing too. He was talking about living in San Francisco area too, where anything goes almost, as well as what anything can be said or thought, obviously. And I tend to draw a distinction between the doing and the saying. And I would be real reluctant to put the clamps on the person's ability to speak something like the Zen Buddhist or Mr. Moon in his meditation shirt. I suspect you got them there too. Lest the next 50 years they put the quietus on me as a Christian minister or somebody else. But, now, if I've got the gun, I'm going to go out and shoot somebody or go down the left-hand side of the road. That's doing something. I make a distinction there, and that's sort of helpful to me.
But you know, in the human life, as I've dealt with people, and I'm, you know, inexperienced, I'll be honest, I'm a very young person. Well, not as young as I wish I was. You know, some fool will get up on his soapbox and begin to yell, and it takes almost, as a matter of fact, it's frightening to me how quickly a person can achieve a following. And people take what he has said and his direction of leadership as being a reality. And so that speaking, and I think the Bible is very plain about this, you know, speaking and acting are not dissimilar. As a matter of fact, they're almost identical. And we in our culture have made a division there, which I'm beginning to say is not as true as we would like to think it is. You know, God spoke that it happened. The knowing of a man's name in the Old Testament with the knowing of that person. And I think that there's still a lot of that around in humanity. And as I see things that are happening, I say, yeah, speaking and acting are not very far enough. I guess that frightens me.
Let me add, and then Signe, it's your turn. Let me add that we have not. While this distinction between speaking and acting is one to which we have paid a good deal of at least lip service, we point out that we are not adhering to it very carefully any longer. We have laws that prohibit people from speaking unless they speak the truth with the truth determined by federal agencies. Huh? We're full of laws like that. Now, you might say, I'm talking, of course, about laws on false advertising or full disclosure. Full disclosure. What is full disclosure? You know, and really, it isn't easy to determine what is full disclosure when on the back of your Sears bank statement, it's getting so full now that you can't find what you're looking for. But, you know, there's sensory overload. But a lot of people will say, and I'm sympathetic to this argument, well, the Bill of Rights, which says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, was talking about political speech, not commercial speech. But then, irony of ironies, when the oil companies started running ads that were political speech, then the squawking really began in some circles, that business firms should only be allowed to publish commercial ads, no political ads. Gee whiz. You know, well, we're It's fuzzy. I know you can defend it. You can say, well, it's a corporation. Corporations shouldn't be allowed to do things. But now, wait a minute. Now we've also put limits on individuals, on the amount that an individual can contribute to a political campaign. And we say, well, that's in order to give everybody a chance to speak. You know, we've always got this defense, but you're really limiting. You see, look, here's one thing. Elton John, he's the only rock star I know. I don't know him. I just know his name. But suppose Elton John wants to support Ronald Reagan for president. Is that crazy? I don't know. All right, anyway, you know, how much money can Elton John give Ronald Reagan? He can stay. He can give him his services. He could stage a rock concert, a benefit rock concert, which would be worth $100,000. Whereas some rich man can only give $1,000. So, you know, what we've said is that businessmen cannot contribute to the candidates of their choice, but rock stars can. I just think we're very muddy on what we're doing here. And of course, then all the things, too, that people will say that certain actions are really speech. Like when I burn the flag. That has been, and there's a case can be made for it. That's a symbolic gesture. It's communication. It's not really an action. Lots of problems here. Okay, Signe.
Well, I'm going to change the subject.
Go ahead. I got to put my glass on and look at you because the light is glaring behind you. You're brilliant. Yeah, there weren't too many good Christians among them. They used a lot of Christian rhetoric. And they were heavily deists, which was the religion of the 18th century. Lots of people, you know, think that Christianity is in a period of slow decline. They're worried about that, but that's really not true. Christianity has gone through periods of decline and revival, and one of the periods of great decline was the 18th century. And that may be useful thing to remember for those who are despairing of the decline of religious belief and the decline of morality too, by the way. You know, we think that the 20th century, what they do in the 20th century, they were doing those things in the 18th century. Actually, the 19th century is the sort of weirdo. They weren't Christians. I cannot offhand, I'm sure, just my ignorance. If Erling were here, he would tell us the names of several Orthodox Christians among the founding fathers. I know there were some, but I can't offhand cite any. I know Washington wasn't, Jefferson wasn't, Franklin surely wasn't. I think John Adams was.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the neat things that has helped me in this whole subject is that they have a sense of history. My wife and I were on our choir tour way back in 65, where we went around Europe. And in Sweden in particular, we would be greeted by all the dignitaries, and they would start out by saying, our camp is founded about 800 AD, and blah, blah, blah. You know, we got bored stiff after we've been to about 10 towns. But I can't get that out of my mind. Now, here we are celebrating 200 measly years of history, and you know, we think that everything that's wrapped up in anything has gone on in that time. And we are without roots, a nation without roots.
But those are pretty good roots, you know. A lot of nations, the folk may go, the ethnic group may go back a while, but
right.
How many governments go back?
Oh, yeah. But the people have roots.
Yeah.
And I think that there is we have a neurosis here because of that. And I think that history is a very important thing. We might want to get hold of the Bible, which is very historically anchored in for many years. It shows the rise and fall of society.
Well, rather though than emphasize the shallowness of a mere 200-year root, I'd like to encourage you to think of the richness of the roots, and I hope we do go back. Again, to quote Burke, he says, people which never look offend them, your neighbors can coerce you. In fact, violence is a coercion. If it has ever occurred to you that if you're living in a city where it isn't safe to go out on the streets, you don't have liberty? It's a very important form of you really don't. And there it isn't government that's threatening you. Really, it's the weakness of government that is threatening you, isn't it?
if the government could enforce the laws, you would be freer, you would have more liberty. But the question is, how much liberty ought we to have? You know, the standard answer is, everyone should be free to do whatever he pleases as long as he doesn't interfere with the similar freedom of others. The trouble is, that's systematically ambiguous. It really begs the question that we know what legitimate liberty is. May I, for example, take your, I'm hungry, and I should be free to eat, so I take your cookie. No, that's interfering with your right to eat your cookie. All right, but suppose I don't take your cookie directly. You have a gasoline station from which you're earning income, with which you buy cookies, and I set up a gasoline station on the opposite corner, and I'm a better gasoline station operator, and I deprive you of your customers and take your income, and thereby take your cookies. Well, you say, well, that's legit. But why is one legit and not the other? Obviously, we have notions of what is legitimate here. You can't really define freedom, I think, or liberty, without talking about justice. When we say we ought to be free, we're really saying it is just that people be free to do certain things. You know, and if somebody says, suppose somebody's driving down the left-hand side of the highway, and the cop stops you. The person says, you're interfering with my liberty. That's absurd. Nobody has the right, you see, you got to get into the right. Nobody has the right to drive down the left-hand side. But what rights do we have? I referred to the argument of the populists and progressives. You know, the tradition coming out of William Jennings Bryan and leading into Theodore Roosevelt around the turn of the century, there was a widespread feeling in the United States that the great American experiment was being corrupted by the plutocrats, that great wealth and great financial power was coming to control the country, and what was needed was some kind of return to our origins and a purging of the fat cats. That, you know, very oversimplified, is what was running through or what was informing the populist progressive movement. Well, during this period, I said, the view came to be argued that the Declaration of Independence had been very much about democracy, the Constitution was very much about liberty for the rich, and that we really had to get back to the principles of 76. Because we had to get back to the principles of 76 in the name of democracy. People rule. That's the important thing, that the people rule. Well, what is democracy? You think about that very often. What constitutes democracy? Again, democracy is one of those words that thou darest not slander in the United Nations. I'm not picking on the United Nations. I'm just saying that I'm assuming that what is acceptable rhetoric in the forum of the United Nations indicates what people consider to be good things and bad things. And everybody's democratic. There's the People's Democratic Republic of Albania. What nation today would stand up and say, we reject democracy? There are all kinds of forms of government, but they all claim to be democratic. And we say, yeah, but they're cheating. Well, are they really? What's our notion of democracy? Abraham Lincoln talked about government of the people, by the people, for the people. I'm not sure what he meant by those three things, but if you run down through them for a moment, let me give an interpretation of each. Government by the people, well, I take that to mean where one man, one vote. Everybody gets a vote. That's government by the people. Of the people might be town meeting thing, participatory democracy. Now those are very, very, very different, you know. And it's not just, I don't think it's just true that when you get big, then you have to choose representatives, but it's really the same thing. It really isn't the same thing. Because when you are actually participating in the process of government, you're doing something different, you're changing yourself. But of course, I don't want to get any further into that. That's something I very deeply believe, that political life is a process of self-change. But it isn't if you think we have the essence of democracy and good government as long as everybody gets a vote, then you're not going to be very impressed by the necessity for participatory democracy where people are really engaging in dialogue with one another about problems of the political order. Or, you know, the real thing is, real challenge today between the Marxists and the non-Marxists on whether a government, whether the people, what the people want is what the people ought to have. Is government by the people necessarily government for the people? Suppose that the people have been brainwashed. Suppose that the means of education are entirely in the hands of the capitalists, or that those who, you know, those who teach in the schools, those who write the newspaper editorials or decide what appears in the paper, they have been so steeped in capitalist ideology that they can't even see how absurd this system is. And what is really in the interest of the people is a radically different kind of order that most of the people can't even recognize. Now, you know, it sounds very elitist. Maybe it is. But I would say, in defense of the Marxists who claim that government, the real democracy, is government for the people, even when the people don't know what they are for, but the Marxists always claim that after a while, after a period of education, the people will come to say, yes, indeed, that is what we want. But what do you mean by democracy, assuming that you're a proponent? Well, what do you mean? Majority rule? Then how do you distinguish between democracy and tyranny of the majority? Again, that's something that I find my students don't ask. They seem very surprised to hear that there is such a thing as tyranny of the majority. They define it, that's a contradiction in terms. What the majority wants is right. And if you don't like it, what about the rights of the minorities? Does democracy say anything about the rights of minorities? What are the limits on the majority? Or is it possible that democracy is really something quite different from all of this? Bryce, in his very famous book, The American Commonwealth, written in 1887, suggests that democracy is government by discussion. That's an old tradition, too. That's something very different. All right. Or was perhaps America the founding about equality? Well, Alexis de Tocqueville, in Democracy in America, maintains that the Americans are gung-ho for equality. And again, you go back to the early years and you can find, in the period of the founding, a lot of talk about equality. There was, in 1776 and the years following, a very strong hostility toward distinctions of status. You know, the kind of thing that is expressed in the French Revolution in calling everyone citizen, or in the Bolshevik Revolution, everyone's comrade. None of this sir stuff. And the Constitution's hostility toward granting titles. We'll have no titles. We're all common men. In America, we're all proud to be common people. Well, there's the thrust toward equality. Is that really what America was about? That, well, Thomas Jefferson said it. All men are created equal. Now, we've had a lot of fun pointing out that Jefferson was a slaveholder and all of that, but you know, maybe Jefferson, well, we know Jefferson felt very badly about being a slaveholder. I hope that if you get to Washington and you go to the Jefferson Memorial, that you will read not only the words of the Declaration of Independence, but the, I think, far more moving words written on the other side. I tremble for my nation when I remember that God is just. Commerce between master and slave is desperate. But if America has a strong, and it does, there is in the founding a great deal of interest in equality. Equality with respect to what? Huh? What? What is equal? Then that last thing, the good life. You may wonder where that comes in, but there's always been in the American political tradition a sense of we are the chosen people. It perhaps begins with the Puritans, who thought that indeed God had sent them out to found the new Jerusalem. But it runs, you know, the idea of manifest destiny was hooked up with it. It's just, we're deeply, that's a rich part of our tradition and a dangerous part of our tradition. It enabled us to get rid of the Indians without a bad conscience because the Indians, you know, weren't part of God's scheme. and God had sent us over here in order to civilize the continent and till it and cultivate it. But I don't want to focus on the manifest destiny or the idea that we were a light to lighten the Gentiles so much as that there was, at the time of the founding, the founding fathers and American Senate weren't just saying, let's get rid of England, let's have liberty, democracy, equality. They were also saying, let us have the true good life. When they commissioned the same man, I can't think of his name, the guy who did the famous statue of Voltaire, Houdon, I think that's right. Help, somebody know? Commissioned him to do a statue of George Washington. He did the statue of Washington in Roman garb with a toga. Well, it was the picture of Cincinnatus. You know, Cincinnatus was this Roman farmer who was called from the plow to lead his nation and fend off the barbarian hordes and then go back to the plow. That was the true good life. Thomas Jefferson, again, has a lot of this running through him. Thomas Jefferson, who believed in limited government, went out and bought the Louisiana Territory and has often been faulted for that. You know, it's inconsistent with his principles. But Thomas Jefferson had this principle. He believed that we had to be a nation of yeomen, farmers, you know, freeholders, everybody with his own terrain out there, everybody growing his own crops and thereby maintaining a lusty independence and writing his own poetry. There was a strong conception of what a man, what a human being ought to be, and the belief that the United States of America was going to be a place in which people could become what they really ought to be. That's what I mean by the good life. So that it isn't enough just to have all of these institutions. However, I want to say this about it. There was, on the part of at least of the adopters of the Constitution, a very conscious decision to soft pedal the Platonic Aristotelian tradition in favor of the tradition of Montesquieu and Locke. You know, if you've read The Republic of Plato, it's dealing with the question of justice. What is justice? And is justice good? And in order to get at that question, Plato, Socrates really have to go back and talk about the nature of being human. And it turns out in The Republic, which is, I think, the product of Plato's most idealistic political thinking. You know, later on, he says, it's not attainable, I'll compromise. But what Plato really believed, that the good society and the good life were inseparable. That the good life was only possible in a polis, in a political community, and you had to have the right kind of political community to make the right kind of life possible. So a nation had to be concerned with the character of its citizens. Is that a dangerous notion and contrary to the principles of the Bill of Rights? Well, I will say this, that it was somewhat soft-pedaled, but somewhat soft-pedaled. Madison, for example, who's the big soft-peddler of it, and Hamilton, and Jay, the Federalist Papers here, they're talking about institutions primarily. But there's always in the background that, and sometimes it comes through too, a concern about national character. A guy I admire very much, Irving Kristol, who has said that we've gotten the whole thing turned around. The founding fathers were very concerned about national character, and they were willing to impose some restrictions on people's behavior if it was necessary to improve character. But today, we've decided that there are absolutely no restrictions of any kind to be placed on people, especially when those restrictions might have something to do with moral development. If they merely have to do with, you know, economic transactions, it's all right to restrict them. But if they have to do with moral development, then it is a violation of one's basic freedoms to have the government put down any rules. So he said, thus, if my 18-year-old daughter decides to perform sex on the stage for pay, the state will say that's all right, as long as she's paid the minimum wage. That's really true. Her employer could be fined for failing to pay her the minimum wage. And we don't see, there's nothing wrong, you know, with the government saying that a woman and a man cannot enter into an arrangement to perform sex
where did my negatives come? I mean, there's no, there can't pass any laws to prohibit arrangements between people to perform sex for pay and for entertainment. But you can prohibit people from entering into free arrangements to, I'll do this for you for $1.90, you know, like wash your dishes. Nope, I got, can't do that. It's got to be $2.20, even if I decide I won't hire you, $2.20. Well, that's all I'm going to say. Yeah. I want to, I hope I've raised just a whole lot of questions.
One question I have, but I have a district question.
You're not supposed to have any questions. I ask the questions, you give the answers. Go ahead, I'm kidding.
Well, I had a history professor very fond of saying that America was not founded on any kind of democracy or anything, that it was a stroke of luck that the United States was founded on democracy. It got off the ground because why was that there was a few smart people in the cellular, like Jefferson, and they did not run any kind of democracy, but they ran it by themselves while saying all this idealism that it, but they realized that there were a bunch of people in this country that couldn't run a government no matter how many, you know, how much, even if they had a vote. Well, he was very fond of saying that it was
well, one thing I'm sure, I'm just amazed when I go back and read the works of political philosophy written in this period at the genius, at the large numbers of men of genius who were, I mean, I think the Federalist Papers ranks with any work of political philosophy. We were indeed most fortunate. They were men of genius. They and one thing I surely agree with, that their conception of democracy was not the conception that most people hold today, and it sounds to me like it's not your history professor's conception of democracy. You know, that's why the Constitution has all of these limitations. They believe that, well, for example, some of which we've gotten rid of by constitutional amendments, some of which have just evolved into insignificance. The Electoral College was supposed to be a way of keeping the people from getting together and just, you know, electing some president whom the majority, you know, some guy named Jimmy Carter or something who, you know, has a big smile, or Ronald Reagan who miles and I think what happened, they were trying to prevent exactly what so easily happens today. Somebody who's got a presence on TV can rile up the majority of the people, or what they were more afraid of was that somebody would come up with a real popular scheme. Electoral College was supposed to be a way of keeping the people from getting together and just, you know, electing some president whom the majority, you know, some guy named Jimmy Carter or something who, you know, has a big smile, or Ronald Reagan who miles and I think what happened, they were trying to prevent exactly what so easily happens today. Somebody who's got a presence on TV can rile up the majority of the people, or what they were more afraid of was that somebody would come up with a real popular scheme for despoiling the wealthy, for seizing property. They did talk about that a lot, but they thought with Locke that property was essential to liberty. So that they were very concerned to prevent majority rule, which is precisely what many people they mean by democracy. And so senators were not directly elected, but were chosen by the legislatures of the states. Now, was that real democracy? Well, whether they were really Democrats depends, first of all, on what you think real democracy is, and I think that's a toughie.
What do you think about the idea that it was just by a shot in the dark, that
I just say, luck is a thing. What is luck? Luck is what we don't yet know how to explain. I think I would rather than say it was luck, I would say I'm extremely grateful. That makes sense. I really do. I really want to celebrate the 4th this year in the bicentennial, because I'm extremely grateful for the genius and courage and integrity of those people who founded this country. Well.
Freedom is only in Christ. I think that freedom is a virtue, and freedom has to be controlled, because God did.
we make it a robot, we made it from the beginning, so it didn't happen just by accident.
Okay, I want to get clear on what you're saying. You're saying that liberty is Christian. I mean, because God wants people to have political freedom so that they can make choices. But which choices? I mean, how many choices? But which freedom can you? You know, I don't want to push you into a corner, but what freedom is? I mean, which particular freedom? Freedom of worship, clearly. But what others? Are there some freedoms which, for whose retention you would argue, on the grounds that you are a Christian? I mean, is freedom of speech, for example, something that a Christian must support?
Each are individuals and uniquely made by God to carry out His plan in our lives. And I think control the minds of people according to those that are in charge. Why then to make robots out of them? We can lend ourselves into all kinds. As we permit God to control us as individuals and as a nation, then we have true freedom. Otherwise, we have enslavement.
What if, let me ask you a question. What if someone wants to propagandize for atheism? Would you allow the person to do so?
If that happens, that the Lord can help the individuals that are listening to atheism to realize how wrong each one has a right to think for themselves. I think an atheist sometimes through nature, God is through nature and everything that He's created and made, and so they can probably be wrong.
You're giving expression, among other things, to a tradition that's very strong in this country among Christians, that there is a kind of correlation between the American political system and Christianity. There was a newspaper I used to get years ago called Christian Economics. I didn't subscribe, it was sent to me. but its masthead said, free enterprise is the system with the least amount of government and the greatest amount of Christianity. And his argument essentially was that anything that increases the power of government decreases the freedom of the individual and hence his capacity to live in a Christian way. That is, I'm not endorsing that tradition, I'm saying, but I think you're expressing that tradition, which is widely held. I don't know, it's Signe or you or name. What's your name?
Earl Peterson. I live in Chicago. I grew up on the farm, loved to shoot and ride horseback, things like that. I've been opposed to legislation about guns. About a year ago, last summer, one day I was out in my yard, and I knew I heard someone shooting. It took me 2 or 3 days to find out who it was and where it came from. My neighbor boy, just 1 yard away, was shooting squirrels with a .22. Scared me to death. And I believe in freedom, but not for him. I'm a pastor in a dwindling church in the city. I meet people who are in the city, certain worship. propagating all kinds of things that are frightening to me as a Christian. And, you know, I'm really struggling with this business of freedom of speech. How free are we to propagate anything that can enter our mind? And, you know, as a Christian person, I find myself very much against my upbringing, beginning to say, no, there have got to be some limitations. And, you know, I find this is a very big struggle that's going on now. You see, and I know all this stuff about freedom and liberty and a good life, but I see some of this as going past the point of no return or diminishing return, you know, so that there is a destruction beginning to happen because we say, yes, everyone should be able to do what they want to. In our city council, I was thinking, this is another thing, but the majority can become a tyranny. You know, we have our minority aldermen who are always painted as funny little comedians, you know, never winning. And, you know, we begin to say, well, you know, is freedom all that good? Or is it more basically, are we as free as we think we are? These are things that are all tied up and going on within me right now, very pertinent to where I am. And you've touched a number of those tender spots this morning. I'm just kind of spewing out a response to you.
Yeah, I appreciate that's the kind of reflection I was hoping for. It gives me an opportunity to point out too that it is very important that we pay attention to what the framing fathers assumed people definitely would not do when they said everyone should be free to do what he wants to do. Edmund Burke said, before I should congratulate a man on his acquiring the freedom to do as he pleases, I would want to know what it is that what it pleases him to do. And we pay attention to that. I mean, it's.
I wrestled with this thing too. He was talking about living in San Francisco area too, where anything goes almost, as well as what anything can be said or thought, obviously. And I tend to draw a distinction between the doing and the saying. And I would be real reluctant to put the clamps on the person's ability to speak something like the Zen Buddhist or Mr. Moon in his unification church, I suspect you got them there too. Lest the next 50 years they put the quietus on me as a Christian minister or somebody else there. Now, if I've got the gun, I'm going to go out and shoot somebody or go down left hand side of the road, that's doing something. I make a distinction there, and that's sort of helpful to me.
But you know, in the human life, as I've dealt with people, and I'm, you know, inexperienced, I'll be honest, a very young person, not as young as I wish I was. You know, some fool will get up on your soapbox and begin to yell, and it takes almost, as a matter of fact, it's frightening to me how quickly a person can achieve a problem. And people take what he has said and his direction of leadership as being a reality. And so that speaking, and I think the Bible is very plain about this, you know, speaking and acting are not dissimilar. As a matter of fact, they're almost identical. And we in our culture have made a division there, which I'm beginning to say is not as true as we would like to think it is. You know, if God spoke that it happened. The knowing of a man's name in the Old Testament with the knowing of that person. And I think that there is still a lot of that around in humanity. And as I see things that are happening, I say, yeah, speaking and acting are not very far. I guess that frightens me.
Let me add, and then Signe, it's your turn. Let me add that we have not. While this distinction between speaking and acting is one to which we have paid a good deal of at least lip service, we point out that we are not adhering to it very carefully any longer. we have laws that prohibit people from speaking unless they speak the truth, with the truth determined by federal agencies. Huh? We're full of laws. Now you might say, I'm talking, of course, about laws on false advertising or full disclosure. Full disclosure. You know, what is full disclosure? You know, and really, it isn't easy to determine what is full disclosure when on the back of your Sears bank statement, it's getting so full now that you can't find what you're looking for. But, there's sensory overload. But a lot of people will say, and I'm sympathetic to this argument, well, the Bill of Rights, which says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, was talking about political speech, not commercial speech. But then, irony of ironies, when the oil companies started running ads that were political speech, then the squawking really began in some circles, that business firms should only be allowed to publish commercial ads, no political ads. Gee whiz. You know, well, it's fuzzy. I know you can defend it. You can say, well, it's a corporation. Corporations shouldn't be allowed to do things. But now, wait a minute. Now we've also put limits on individuals, on the amount that an individual can contribute to a political campaign. And we say, well, that's in order to give everybody a chance to speak. You know, we've always got this defense, but you're really limiting. You see, look, here's one thing. Elton John, he's the only rock star I know. I don't know him. I just know his name. But suppose Elton John wants to support Ronald Reagan for president. Is that crazy? I don't know. All right, anyway, you know, how much money can Elton John give Ronald Reagan? He can give him his services. He could stage a rock concert, a benefit rock concert, which would be worth $100,000. Whereas some rich man can only give $1,000. What we've said is that businessmen cannot contribute to the candidates of their choice, but rock stars can. I just think we're very muddy on what we're doing here. And of course, then all the things too that people will say that certain actions are really speech. Like when I burn the flag, that has been, and there's a case can be made for it. That's a symbolic gesture, it's communication, it's not really an action. Lots of problems here. Okay, Sigmund.
Well, I'm going to change the subject.
Go ahead. I got to put my glass on and look at you because the light is glaring behind you. You're brilliant. Yeah, there weren't too many good Christians among them. They used a lot of Christian rhetoric. And they were heavily deists, which was the religion of the 18th century. Lots of people think that Christianity is in a period of slow decline. They're worried about that, but that's really not true. Christianity has gone through periods of decline and revival, and one of the periods of great decline was the 18th century. And that may be useful thing to remember for those who are despairing of the decline of religious belief and the decline of morality too, by the way. You know, we think that the 20th century, what they do in the 20th century, they were doing those things in the 18th century. Actually, the 19th century is the sort of weirdo. That was the when they weren't Christians. I cannot offhand, I'm sure, just my ignorance. If Erling were here, he would tell us the names of several Orthodox Christians among the founding fathers. I know there were some, but I can't offhand cite any. I know Washington wasn't, Jefferson wasn't, Franklin surely wasn't. I think John Adams was.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the neat things that has helped me in this whole Sunday school area is they have a sense of history. My wife and I were on our choir tour way back in 1965, where we lived around Europe. And in Sweden in particular, we would be greeted by all the dignitaries, and they would start out by saying our camp was founded about 800 AD, and blah, blah, blah. You know, we got bored stiff after we did about 10 towns. But I can't get that out of my mind. You know, here we are celebrating 200 measly years of history, and you know, we think that everything that's wrapped up in anything has gone on in that time. And we are without roots, a nation without roots.
But those are pretty good roots, you know. A lot of nations, the folk may go, the ethnic group may go back a while, but
right.
How many governments go back?
Oh, yeah, but the people have roots.
Yeah.
And I think that there is we have a neurosis here because of that. And I think that history is a very important thing. We might want to get hold of the Bible, which is very historically anchored into it for many years. It shows the rise and fall of society.
Well, rather though than emphasize the shallowness of a mere 200-year root, I'd like to encourage you to think of the richness of the roots, and I hope we do go back. Again, to quote Burke, he says, people which never looks backward to its ancestors will not be able to look forward to posterity. And Burke tended to think of a nation as an unwritten contract which the present generation had fulfilled between the past and the future. I really think that, you know, Burke has some funny arguments. Sorry to be quoting Burke so much, but Burke comes up with the interesting argument that rich people should have more votes than people of modest means. Awful thought. Although, of course, there were property restrictions on the vote when the country was founded. And they seem to think that was quite consistent with democracy and everything else. But Burke also argues that people who have inherited their wealth should have even more influence. You say, why? He says, because they've inherited their wealth, they are more grateful to the past. And therefore, they are more likely to care for the future. Now, before you sneer at that, before you sneer at the idea, ask yourself, who are the people who have the rich people who have this great sense of the public interest and really give of themselves and their resources to the society? They often tend to be those who have inherited great wealth, or who, like Rockefeller said, gee, I had everything money could buy, so to go out and pursue a career in public service, that sense of noblesse oblige. But anyway, my real point was, if you don't look back to the past, I think you're a bit too quick to throw away the present, and without regard to the future. So we didn't evolve overnight. Signe?
Well, I would say that our roots go back much further than the 200 years, and that possibly ours are richer because we go back to Sweden and Scotland and Edinburgh. And I think today there's a tendency to, rather than ignore our ethnic heritage, to go back
That is an interesting phenomenon. That's a different kind of roots, though, and it can be divisive. But on the other hand, perhaps the United States is just too big and abstract an entity to bind us together. It may well be that if we are to be bound together into a genuine society, we're going to have to be bound on the basis of something narrower and more specific than. Again, gee, Burke is just coming to mind. Burke says, no one ever learns to love humanity who does not first learn to love that little platoon to which he belongs. Well, it's about time for coffee break, and I always feel it's an injustice when the people who sit here patiently don't get any of the leftover Swedish pancakes. So.